name is Honey. I'm almost 30 and I use Instagram to share pictures of my art. Okay, I know what you're thinking. Honey is a weird name, so please don't tell me what I already know. No, it's not a nickname. My parents are from California and they're like uber hippies, so go figure. As you can probably guess, I grew up in this overly loving, peacenik environment, which I'm sure sounds cool at first, but let's just say it left me wholly unprepared to deal with some of the darker things in life. Needless to say, I really struggled with my mental health in my mid to late 20s. I don't want to totally blame my parents for that, I think they did the best that they could, but they seriously didn't help with their "just fill your heart with love" nonsense, when what I needed was actual therapy and antidepressants. I got access to professional help in the end, but what really helped me keep it together in the meantime was my art. Before I started to suffer with depression and stuff, I used to paint and draw some pretty basic stuff. Landscapes, portraits, floral displays, stuff like that. But when I started to really suffer, I let out all my stress, anxiety, and sadness on the paper, and as weird as it sounds, that's when my art really started to flourish. It was probably the only silver lining to ever come out of my poor mental health. The more I posted my newer, darker art on Instagram, the more attention it got. My follower count shot up, I got offers for commissions, I actually managed to hook up with a t-shirt merch company and make a few sales that way too. Like I drew this pizza demon thing one time and that made me a few $100 from people wanting that thing on a t-shirt too. So when I say dark, I really do mean I started drawing some really messed up stuff. The pizza demon thing was probably the lightest hearted thing I put out there in that time, and even then, people said it was super messed up. So as you might imagine, my new followers included some pretty messed up people. I don't say that to be like I'm complaining or mean or anything. I say that because one of them in particular made my life pretty difficult. So I get a direct message off of this guy who says he really loved my work and wanted a piece commissioned. Of course I say yes. So he follows up by asking what my rates are. I had no idea what I was doing in terms of dollar amounts at that time, so when I quoted him like $80 for a picture, he started explaining that I needed to value my art more, how my work was just as valuable as any other, and how I should be charging a whole bunch more for my art. I had no idea what to up my amount to, so I kind of threw out a few ballpark figures before the guy makes my jaw hit the floor when he offers me a straight grand for an A3 size picture of whatever I wanted to draw or paint. I couldn't believe it. $1,000 for a picture? Which was more money than I'd ever made in my whole life. I got to work straight away, and within a week, I'd poured my heart and soul out onto paper and sent it off, and got my money via PayPal. Having that kind of affirmation actually lifted my mood to the highest it had been in months. I felt valued, like I could contribute something to the world. I was still dealing with my demons, but when I learned that I could actually profit from them, that I could make use of something that plagued me, it was a great feeling. I stayed in touch with the guy. I'd never been so grateful to anyone in my life until that point, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't think I'd be able to get more money out of him if he wanted something else commissioning. We used to talk back and forth a fair bit, and he shared that he too was an artist. I asked him what kind of artist he was, and he told me that he worked in some very unusual mediums. Naturally, this only got me all the more curious, as I got super dark with my art too, but he seemed pretty timid to talk about it. I get that people can be shy about showing off their artwork. I was pretty shy too at one point, but this guy needed some serious coaxing in order to show me anything. When he finally agreed to show me anything, he told me that he'd do it via one of those self-destructing messages that InstaNow does. I didn't question anything. Like, I knew he'd send one of those self-destructing pictures, maybe so he could protect his intellectual property or something. I was a little confused as to why he didn't seem to trust me, but hey, I pretty much adored this guy, so like I said, I didn't ask too many questions. I waited patiently for him to send me a picture of some of his work. It took a minute or two, but he sends me this 3-second self-destructing picture that I was honestly super excited to see by that point. But when I actually saw what it was, even if it was for a real brief time, I really, really wish I hadn't. It looked like a goat's head in a jar of some kind, and the fluid it was floating in looked sort of greenish black, and I'm pretty sure it was formaldehyde. But it wasn't just that. The guy had opted to make a few little additions to the goat head, additions that I couldn't all catch because of how quick the picture flashed before my eyes, but the ones that I saw were horrible. It looked like he carved the lips away so that all the creature's teeth were showing, and on each one was carved or written a little symbol. I'm also pretty sure he either chemically changed the creature's eyes or replaced them entirely with a kind of metal or semi-precious stone. They had this weird glint to them. Like I said, there wasn't enough time for me to drink the whole thing in, but there was plenty more about the creature's head that had been messed with. It wasn't the details which really got to me. It was the idea that the corpse of an animal had been so horribly disrespected just so he could try to make some kind of art out of it. I had questions, a lot of questions, but the first thing I had to ask him was if it was really real or just some kind of mock-up of a skull. He told me it was real, very real, and that he'd gotten hold of a goat's head from a butcher, preserved it, and then basically surgically edited the thing over time, mostly using dental tools, apparently for the sake of precision. I personally thought the whole thing was a disgrace. I'm vegan, and I try to stay as ethical as possible, but at the same time, I didn't want to go imposing my own worldview on the guy, especially since I liked him so much. I also didn't want to offend him, so I told him his work was interesting and jaw-dropping. Then asked if he worked with ink and paper or any variation on that. He told me no, and that he only worked with skulls, how they were the capsule that held all the hopes and dreams and fears and needs of the once living creature they belonged to, and that working with them was kind of sacred. I didn't really know what to say to that. He was right in a way. He sounded absolutely crazy for saying it out loud, but I couldn't entirely refute his point. It was like talking to some kind of insane genius almost. Not long after, he asked me if he thought he was cruel to work in such a medium. I told him people might find his work provocative, maybe even objectionable, but that it was fascinating nevertheless. And then he asked if I wanted to see more. Unlike the first time, there was no doubt in me that I most definitely did not want to see any more of this guy's work, but like I said before, I also really didn't want to offend him. So what could I do? It took me much longer to reply to his message that time, but in the end, I told him sure, and he replied saying that he'd use another self-destructing message. Again, I waited a minute or two for the message to come through, and when it did, I opened up the message thread and tapped the little reveal message thing with some reluctance. The first time around for that goat heads thing, I at least had some degree of curiosity, but at that time, I was just plain horrified by what I saw. It was a monkey's head, or at least it looked like it was some kind of primate. And if I thought the goat's head had received some disturbing additions, this latest one turned out to be 1,000 times worse. It was so bad I only caught the briefest glimpse of it and just had to look away and lock my phone screen to get it away from me. I was a little more confrontational with him after that, telling him that one was considerably more disturbing than the first, and I thought it was maybe a little too sensitive to see any more of his work. He asked why, and I broke it to him that I'd been vegan for a few years, that I was a real animal lover, and although I could stomach the goat thing's head, I really couldn't handle the monkey head as it looked far too human to me. That's when he replies to me all like, it's interesting you should say that, and goes on to explain that it's his dream to work with a human skull, how he's put up a few ads on 4chan and stuff asking if anyone would be willing to donate their head should they die, but hadn't gotten any replies. Then he told me that he was getting really impatient, and that he was worried he wouldn't get a chance to realize his dream. The whole exchange had reached peak creepiness by that point, as you can imagine, and it was fast getting to the point when I was reaching for that block option, as I just didn't feel safe talking to him anymore. So by the time he actually messaged me another self-destructing message asking if I'd be willing to help him get hold of a human head, I just noped out of there and stopped replying to him. Like, I'm not sure he was actually asking me to, like, kill anyone with him or for him, but just the idea of going about procuring an actual human head, God, no. but I couldn't bring myself to block him. Like, he was a potential source of sales after all, and I could make a lot of money from the guy if I kept him interested in my work. I try not to think about it, but I get these really bad feelings from time to time. Like, what if he catches on to the fact that I just ignore him? And what if he decides that my head is the one he'd like to use to complete his magnum opus? I try very careful with what I post now, making sure it's only ever pictures of my art, and that the handful of landscape photos I'd posted on my profile had been deleted, just so whoever it is can't get an idea of where I live. Because if they do work out where I'm at, there's just no way I'd be able to go around feeling safe. Not with someone whose ambition is to work with severed human heads, knowing where I lay mine at night. Alexa Sharkey was born in Houston, Texas in the year 1994 to her father, Mike Robinault, and her mother, Stacy. After graduating high school, Alexis initially studied biology education at a university in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but after gaining her diploma, she seemed to be in no rush to get a teaching job and found work at a premium hair and skincare company named Monate. She was still working for Monate when she began to gain a great number of followers on the photography-based social media app, Instagram. A combination of her natural beauty and her champagne lifestyle had users hooked. She and her husband, a wealthy West Texas consultant who was 26 years her senior, were accustomed to vacationing a lot, and Alexis wasted no opportunity to document her travels, sharing pictures with her followers on a daily basis. Not to mention sharing images of the couple's extravagant life around Houston, the place that they made their home. Her posts would be seen, liked, and shared by tens of thousands of people, and by December of 2020, Alexis had over 69,000 followers. Now, as you may know, Instagram users with large amounts of followers are often contacted by private companies and offered large amounts of money in exchange for advertising their products, and Alexis was no different. Within a relatively short period of time, whilst still working full-time selling products for Monate, which has since been accused of being nothing more than a multi-level marketing company, Alexis was getting sponsorship deals which made her income swell to even higher levels than her consultant husband. But all was not well in the Sharkey home. A close friend of Alexis confessed that she had recently confided in her that she was filing for a divorce. Some had always doubted their relationship given that Tom was considerably older than her, and aside from an intense attraction, the couple seemed to have very little in common. Yet for some reason, Alexis didn't move out of the apartment they shared, even though she and Tom were apparently separated. However, she did see an opportunity to get a breakaway from Tom, as Thanksgiving weekend gave her the chance to stay over at a friend's place for the celebrations. She told her soon-to-be ex-husband that she would be back by the weekend, but on the Saturday following Thanksgiving, Alexis's mother, Stacy, received a call from Tom saying that Alexis was missing, and that he hadn't heard from her since Friday. A few days later, on November 28th, Alexis's mother posted to the social media site Facebook, stating that her daughter hadn't been heard from in over 24 hours, adding that police were involved and that Alexis had last been seen in the Houston area. This was especially concerning for Stacy, as she hadn't seen her daughter since the previous Christmas due to travel restrictions caused by the pandemic. Alexis had planned to return home to her parents back in Pennsylvania for Thanksgiving, but as the number of cases continued to rise all over the United States, the family decided it was much safer for Alexis to stay in Texas. But that very same morning that Stacy posted her plea on Facebook, a sanitation worker employed by the city of Houston saw something unusual lying on the side of the road. At first, he simply believed it was some kind of mannequin, due to the lack of clothes and the stiff positioning of the thing's limbs. But the worker's supervisor, a man named John Richardson, later said that the employee had sounded terrified when he called him, saying he'd noticed the apparent mannequin looked a little too real upon closer inspection, and that he suspected the situation to be far worse. John drove down to where the supposed mannequin was lying at the side of the road, then rushed to call 911 when he saw that it was no mannequin at all. That it was, in fact, a lifeless human body. The moment of realization traumatized him, and he later told a local radio station that the sight of the body had been playing in his head every day since he discovered it. 2 days later, on November 30th, Houston Police Department held a press conference in which they announced that they had identified the body as belonging to none other than Alexis Sharkey. Her soon-to-be ex-husband got a call from a local coroner's office, asking him to drive over to identify the body of a potential loved one. He knew immediately that it was going to be Alexis, but somehow found the strength to head on over, where he found her lying on a mortician's table, dead but with no obvious signs of injury. Yet to his horror, after the news of Alexis's death began to circulate in the news, he began to hear rumors that it was his maltreatment of her that had been the cause of her death. Anonymous accounts from people claiming to be friends of Alexis had told a number of online news publications that the separation from her husband had caused a huge amount of tension in their home, a tension that had soured into hatred. These anonymous friends claimed that Alexis herself had told them that some intense arguments had descended into violence more than once, and that her husband had been putting his hands on her. Suddenly, Tom Sharkey found himself bathed in the media spotlight, and for entirely negative reasons. In what became a lightning-quick trial by media, one which was fueled by social media speculation, tens of thousands of furious people assumed that it was Tom that was the murderer, and he began to receive a slew of death threats. It certainly didn't help that initially Tom had refused to comment on his wife's death, but as the threats against him became more and more tangible, he reached out to give a statement to a local ABC affiliate. "She understood me. I understood her. We didn't fight when she left. I just told her she shouldn't drive under the influence," he said, overtly implying that Alexis had been drunk the night that she left her friend's Thanksgiving celebrations. He also seemed to insist that there was no trouble in their marriage, and that they weren't filing for divorce at all. This was something that was backed up by Alexis's mother, who said her daughter would have told her if she was suffering marital problems. When the Harris County Institute of Forensic Sciences conducted an autopsy on Alexis's body, they told reporters that they couldn't rule out the possibility of foul play. This only cemented her mother's suspicions that she met a violent end. "I believe solely that she was murdered because of the manner in which her body was left," Stacy said. "It just drives deep into the soul that something very malicious happened here, and I want to get to the bottom of it." Friends said she confided in them on a recent trip to Mexico that she feared for her life, although she apparently did not say why she held such suspicions. But if this was the case, just who exactly killed Alexis? Police seemed to have pretty much ruled out the idea that she was murdered by her husband, since he was quick to volunteer his cooperation with them in the aftermath of her death, and has since stated that they believe it to be only a matter of time before arrests are made. So perhaps Alexis's murder was related to her career selling beauty products of Monet. Not only has Monet been accused of utilizing the techniques of outlawed, multi-level marketing companies, but the quality of its products has also come into question. In the year before Alexis's death, Monet was allegedly investigated by Florida's Attorney General after hundreds of claims that its products caused a host of hair and skin issues. The company was permanently barred from using false or misleading statements in its marketing and sales of its beauty products, and faced a $1 million fine on top of class action lawsuits from those that, after using the products, claimed they experienced hair loss, balding, and itching. Alexis was a prolific seller of Monet's products, once receiving a check for $10,000 as the winner of a company sales competition. That would certainly make for a lot of women who might blame her for essentially disfiguring them. There's also a decent chance that, since Monet's MLM tactics would leave a lot of people out of pocket, that somewhere down the line Alexis had screwed one of her underlings out of a great deal of cash, perhaps just before the news of Monet's subpar products broke in the media, perhaps leaving a person totally unable to shift a hefty amount of stock they'd purchased. This would doubtless leave a person angry, vengeful, maybe even murderous. And besides, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. If this is indeed the case, and Alexis's death is intrinsically linked to her Monet sales, then it seems that her status as an Instagram influencer actually led to her murder. The influence she exerted over those that followed her no doubt led to increased sales, thus increasing the potential pool of victims for Monet's frankly dangerous products. It's very possible that without Instagram, she may not have made the sale to that one person unhinged enough to seek revenge when their skin began to blister, or their hair began to fall out, or their scalp began to itch unbearably. It seems we'll soon find out who's responsible for Alexis's death. But if it is related to social media, it would be very ironic that a medium that has brought opportunity and new beginnings to so many brought one young woman to her end. A few years ago, I started getting into this Italian crime show called Gomorrah. I must have watched every series of The Sopranos like a zillion times, and a friend of mine recommended Gomorrah to me, selling it to me as being like the Italian Sopranos, only 100 times more brutal and bleak. And needless to say, I was hooked, and I binge-watched the first two series in like a week, usually with my phone nearby so I could text my buddy like, "Oh god, this show's so amazing," every so often, and thanking him to turning me onto it. Then not long after, I'm scrolling through Instagram and I notice I'm getting Italian language sponsored ads. I figured it was just a glitch in the app's algorithm, something like that, and didn't think anything of it. But it kept happening, over and over again. I get all kinds of ads for different products and services that were only available in Italy. I'm a little embarrassed that it took me as long as it did to make the connection between the Italian advertisements and the fact that I've been watching Gomorrah. But when I finally did, it seriously gave me the creeps. My phone was listening to me. My phone had been broadcasting the sound of the TV series to somewhere that was then tailoring the promoted posts in my Insta feed to stuff it was assumed that I might buy. But then if it was listening to me and sending whatever I was saying off to some advertising company or whatever, there's legit nothing to say that the government can't access with that same technology. For years we worried about the possibility of George Orwell's 1984 becoming a reality, fretting over a totalitarian government that would put cameras or microphones in our homes that they could then use to listen to us. But do you think Orwell could have predicted that we'd do it all voluntarily? That all you had to do was package the telescreen in a tiny, shiny package, couple it with social media, and we'd basically hand over our collective privacy on a silver platter? Like, I might sound legit crazy 20 or 30 years ago if I was all like, "They're listening to us. They're spying on us on our phones." But today, it's a matter of record that our devices record ambient noises before analyzing it and passing on keywords to advertisers. And it's not even the fact that it's happening that's the scary part. It's the fact that no one really cares. No one really gives a hoot that we have next to no privacy anymore. I've even heard people talk about Huawei phones like, "I don't care if the Chinese have all my info. What are they going to do with it?" Now I use VPNs on almost every device I own these days, and I don't own a smartphone anymore. Just a flip phone that I can turn off whenever I'm not using it. I don't think I'd actually use voicemail in about a decade, but now I use it all the time. I just find it extremely creepy that we just sleepwalked into this state of affairs without any more thought than, "Ooh, my phone now has a camera," or, "Ooh, now my phone has the internet." I used to think those conspiracy theory types were just a bunch of loons, but if they were right about our phones, what else are they right about?